podcast is part of the Sports Social Podcast Network.
This is the Ridiculous Ashes podcast. I'm Dan Lipke. With me is Alex Bowden.
Hello.
We're covering historical Ashes series to find out which nation is more ridiculous at cricket. Is it England or is it Australia? And the series we're currently covering is the 2013 Ashes.
Yes. We're on the fourth test now, so I'm going to presume you pretty much know how this works. 3-2-1 points for the most ridiculous point of the match. Most points wins the test.
Yeah.
I nominate and argue for England. Dan nominates and argues for Australia, like the proud patriots we are. The situation is England took the third test in large part thanks to Stuart Broad walking, supplemented by Alistair Cook's steadfast refusal to ever use part-time bowlers. David Warner's colourful return to the side earned Australia their only points. Where does that put the series? I've actually forgotten.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure it's 1-1 here. Australia, the first test was a draw, despite the best efforts of Pat Cummins, special guest Pat Cummins. Australia won the second test and England won the third test, as you just mentioned. So all to play for going into the fourth.
Everything to play for. So what happened in the fourth test then, Dan? Refresh everyone's memory, or the younger generations, maybe just tell them what happened because they were too small to be paying attention.
Yes, pay attention, younger generation.
Yeah, damn straight.
England had retained the Ashes after the third test, but technically hadn't quite won the series yet. So they were looking for a victory here in the fourth test at Durham to accomplish that feat as well. Alistair Cook won the toss and batted, and after a pretty steady start that took England to 149 for two, Australia tightened it up in the field, and England were eventually dismissed for 238. In reply, Australia lost some early wickets to Stuart Broad, but then there was a century partnership between Chris Rogers and Shane Watson, who was now batting down the order at six. And then some late hitting from Ryan Harris gave Australia a 32-run lead on the first innings. Then Harris took three quick wickets, but just as Australia thought maybe we might win this actual test, there was another century to Ian Bell and some entertaining late-order slogging from Tim Bresnan and Graham Swan, which set Australia 299 runs for victory. And again, Australia looked to be on target. A century opening partnership from David Warner and Chris Rogers had Australia well set to run down the total, but then a Broad blitz late on the fourth day saw Australia crumble from 147 for one to 224 all out, giving England victory by 74 runs and a 3-0 series lead.
My first nomination is England's old ball version of T20. this was midway through their first innings. England went 20 consecutive overs without hitting a four. They then played out another over without hitting a four for good measure, but T21's not a thing, so I've rebranded it. 21 consecutive overs without a boundary. And what surrounds that passage of play matters too. I think that because that contextualises it. So let's go with beforehand. So in the 63rd over, Matt Prior hit two consecutive fours off Ryan Harris. There were 10 runs off the over, and that took England to 183 for five. So they were sort of chipping along about three and over, so pretty standard fare. From then on, the overs went, and I'm going to say zero here rather than maiden, so it sounds a bit more like binary code. Zero, no ball, 2-0-1-0-0-1-0-0-1-0, and Prior's dismissal. 0-2-2 with Bairstow's dismissal. Wide, 1. Now brace yourself for the big one here. 4, which included a no ball and also Stuart Broad's dismissal. 0-0-0. So,
and just to be clear, they're runs in an over. That's not runs off an individual
delivery.
That's
runs in an over, yes. That's runs in an over, to be 100% clear. That's 16 runs in 21 overs, 13 off the bat. And it took England to 199 for eight after 84 overs.
To be fair, I don't think England's T20 side of the era were scoring a lot quicker than this, were they?
And now, so this is the aftermath, and the next bit is after 84 overs, Australia took the new ball. And three balls in, Swan hit a four off a no ball. So that was kind of the end of the no fours sequence. The next over, there were two more fours. The over after that, Swan was out. But then Jimmy Anderson hit four fours in eight balls. Jimmy Anderson did. So they finished the day on 238 for nine. And those six new ball overs had gone for 39 runs. So
never take 16, a new ball.
16 runs in 21 overs, 39 runs in six overs.
Yeah, that's very good.
That's my nomination. That's my first. first nomination.
Very good nomination. Right, my first nomination comes in Australia's first innings. This is the Watson and Rogers opening, in inverted commas, partnership. So, as we mentioned, David Warner came back in the previous test, and he didn't open in the first innings in that test, but he did open in the second innings, and the selectors came to their senses and realised David Warner is an opener. So Warner and Rogers technically opened, but that meant Shane Watson had to drop all the way down to six. Nevertheless, he and Rogers reunited as soon as the 23rd over. And at that point, they managed to put on 129 runs together, which turned out to be the best partnership by a pair of Australian openers for the entire series. And the only reason Rogers was there to bat, and I really didn't want to mention reviews again because this has been a very review-heavy season, but again, there was an excellent piece of DRS nonsense, which I can't overlook here. So Rogers was caught behind and he was given out. He reviewed it because he was confident that he hadn't hit it. And Hotspot confirmed this. It showed that the ball had, in fact, hit his pad. So he was given not out, caught behind. But, you know, just for entertainment's sake, the umpire, the third umpire said, oh, I'll check the LBW. And it came back as umpire's call. Nevertheless, the decision came back not out because the third umpire asked the on-field umpire whether he'd given him out LBW. And the on-field umpire said, no, I hadn't. And therefore, the umpire's call went Chris Rogers' way, which is the exact opposite of the process as it exists today, right?
Yeah, right. I mean, sorry, when the third umpire called for the review of the LBW, presumably they didn't know the umpire's decision. Is that right? Okay. Because otherwise it would be totally redundant, because if he'd known that it was given not out, he was basically, like you say, just reviewing for the fun of it.
Yes.
Yeah, so just and then went and checked what the umpire had actually decided afterwards.
Yes. So, yeah, so it's, I mean, these days, of course, it doesn't really matter how the umpire has given you out. Even if they think you've edged it, if it turns out it's hit your pad and it's in front, the umpire's call will go the way of the original decision, regardless of what happened. But I like this old method where, you know, you have to get clarity from the on-field umpire. How exactly do you think this is out before the third umpire can apply some kind of umpire's call methodology?
Yeah, the third umpire's greater authority these days. I'm presuming that this was actually, you know, the whole reviews thing was literally part of the reasoning behind Watson's demotion, just to give the batters above him a chance of reviewing.
Well, yeah, I mean, it does increase their opportunities, right? It's double a chance of having a review available for you. Yeah, so Watson went on to score 68. Rogers made his first century in Test cricket, which was very elaborately commentated upon. It was the moment of a lifetime, according to Mark Nicholas, who didn't have particularly high hopes for the rest of Rogers' time on this mortal plane.
He went on from that as well. He said, a moment that will live with him until he has those slippers by the fire, which we know what he's saying there, because he's just talking about sort of going to old age. But the way he words it, that they will live with him until he has, like, it's a thing you just acquire, like you're issued with slippers at a certain age, and then you're just supposed to store them by the fire. That's the kind of like the way I heard it when I heard him say that.
Yeah, I was thinking that perhaps he meant like the slip cordon of England. He's going to, you know, burn them. Damien Martin also went on to talk about the pride that Rogers would feel of scoring a century in the baggy green cap, and this of course was while Rogers was wearing a massive green helmet, standard issue, so all very good.
Why don't Australians wear baggy green helmets, Dan?
I don't know. I think the bagginess is an issue, although you would think that it would supply extra padding, right, the bagginess?
Yeah, I think it would a bit more give, or maybe it would give too much, I don't know.
We'll get them to look into it.
Yeah, Rogers, he was down as being caught behind in that innings, but when you watch it, he was actually caught short leg by the wicketkeeper because Matt Prior did this mad dashing dive. He went absolutely miles to catch it.
Good scurrying.
The other thing I was struck by in his innings was that Graham Swann seemed to bowl an incredible number of full tosses at him. And then I realised he was probably trying to recreate that magic ball where Rogers had taken a swung at it earlier in the series and been out LBW to what was practically a beamer.
Yeah.
Okay, I'll move on to my next nomination then, which is The Summer of Bell, which is one of these sort of grander nominations. But I think these, you know, it's when to put them in, but I think they still apply. A broader series nomination that I've kept in my back pocket, really. Because this is the moment when we have the full picture, I think. So let's first revisit the public perception of Ian Bell at this point. Because Bell had a reputation for being a bit flaky and not really doing much when England really needed him. And the famous accusation was that he only scored hundreds when someone else in the England batting lineup had already made one.
Yep.
And I checked and it wasn't really unfair. His first 900 came that way. The next two came against Bangladesh. And then he was second to three figures as often as not after that until this series. The more recent history was they'd gone into this Ashes with 150 and six tests against New Zealand because they've played back-to-back series.
Yep.
So he's not sort of like coming into the series as the great hero. He then made 109 in each of his first two innings in the series and then 113 in this game. And those were the three tests that England won. Not only that, but the next highest scores in those three innings were 65, 67, and in this match, 45. He came to the crease at 49 for three. England just about ahead on runs, three wickets down. And the top score in the first innings was Alistair Cook's 51. So England were just not making runs.
Yeah.
And then he made 113. It was just the exact opposite of what people thought Ian Bell was all about. It was amazing.
Yeah. Well, I think here in Australia, we didn't really have any real opinion of Ian Bell prior to this series. And then I do strongly remember that just becoming utterly terrified of him during this series as an unstoppable force, like nothing could prevent him from scoring runs. And then about 6 months later, and I think I did mention this in the 2013-14 Ridiculous Ashes, just struggling to recall what the big deal was about Ian Bell because he was went back to being, you know, nothing particularly remarkable again. Just this one summer, the summer of Bell.
The summer of Bell. I mean, there were strong feelings about him this side of the world, and they were polarized. It was either Ian Bell is just an absolute waste of space and we just need a shot of him immediately, or he is such a talented batter, I can't believe people. Because he was always averaging around the point where, you know, he's clearly a good player,
yep,
and he looked amazing. So, but yeah, it was either one or the other. I had a campaign on my website for a while because people were so polarized about it, was to not really have any kind of opinion about Ian Bell at all. It was just, you know, so that was my like official editorial stance, was that I had no opinion about Ian Bell, but kind of knackered it up with this series. This third 100 meant at this point in the series he had 500 runs in four tests at an average of 71.42.
Handy.
If we exclude Joe Root's 180, which we're obliged to do on the basis of root maths,
yes,
then Kevin Peterson was the only other England batter who was averaging over 30. So, you know, fair whack higher. And yeah, it was like peak Ian Bell batting as well. I was watching the highlights of this innings, and most of his fours, it seemed like most of them, at least half of them, were deliberately cut between slip and gully, which just should not be a high percentage shot at all. It's basically just the batting equivalent of taunting suicide.
Yeah, well, speaking of which, the way he scored his century, because this stuck with me, he moved from 97 to 99 by one of these shots, as you mentioned, where he edged, I don't think this one was deliberate, he edged one through a mostly vacant slips cordon. Clark tried to dive from gully back towards fourth slip to almost catch it. And it looked as if it was going to race to the boundary for four to, you know, give him his century. But Warner came around and slid and prevented the four. And so he was stuck on 99 for a bit. And then he moved from 99 to 100 by chipping one through mid-wicket past a fielder by, you know, less than a metre, presumably. And it landed just in front of mid-on, who then had a ping at the stumps at the bowler's end to try and run him out as well. So it was an exciting way to bring up your century.
He kept it colourful as well. And then I don't know when this happened, but at some point in his innings, which may have been like pertinent to when exactly he reached 100, but apparently a hook off Shane Watson brushed the front of umpire Tony Hill's jacket, and it would have gone, they reckon it would have gone for four, but they saved a couple of runs.
Good bowling from Watto.
Absolutely. But the thing is, so this, just as a sort of final word on the summer of Bell, was this really sums up the situation for Ian Bell and like the perception of him in the UK. Because all that really happened was that he played so well that expectations skyrocketed and he then completely failed to meet them from then on. All Ian Bell could ever do was fail to meet expectations or raise them out of his own reach. Those were his two moves, basically.
Yeah.
And I think this is just a perfect example of that. But he did win an Ashes, so like pretty much him.
All right, well, I've got a reasonably neat segue into my next nomination, because my next nomination is Ryan Harris hitting the stumps. And the one moment that I'm particularly thinking of here is early on day four, where he skittled all the stumps to dismiss Bell. It was pretty much like 10-pin bowling. The aftermath was like there was a leg stump out of the ground, middle stump had been knocked back, both bales had flown off in opposite direction. It was like absolute demolishment of the stumps. And then just for good measure, he followed it up with the next ball by knocking the stump out of the ground to dismiss Pryor. Ryan Harris was getting very angry and really putting some oomph into it. I've seen a few times in recent years bowlers hitting the stumps and the bale not even coming off. Harris wasn't having any of that.
There's nothing more satisfying than a flying stump, really. It's so unequivocal.
Yep.
I think particularly like in these days of like, it's an LBW and he's given and maybe that's out or maybe it's not out. Let's wait and see. Let's watch some replays for 5 minutes.
Yep.
Like just watching a stump just battered across the outfield is it's my favourite thing in cricket.
Yeah. So after these two stump scattering deliveries, that meant he was on a hat-trick, of course. And who came out to face the hat-trick? Of course, it would have to be Stuart Broad.
Who else?
Nobody else could come out to face the hat-trick. And Broad managed to negotiate the hat-trick, survive that one, and then went on to hit 13 off 7 deliveries. classic Stuart Broad innings.
This innings for Ryan Harris, his bowling figures were 7 for 117, which is... like, you see figures like that sometimes. Like, it's a freak bowling performance by any standards, but, like, that would be the kind of thing you would see from a spin bowler.
Yes.
Who'd been bowling all day, plugging away. It is... you almost never see that from a seam bowler, because if wickets are going to seamers, then they're going to other people, or they're going quicker, or it's just, like, an incredible workload.
Yeah, well, I mean, and that was kind of one of the issues with Ryan Harris. Like, he was famously, weak-kneed. His knees would break down at a moment's notice, and he was always injured. So the surprise wasn't that he was bowling well. We all knew he could bowl, but the surprise was that he stayed fit long enough to do it, because he bowled in most of the tests in this series, and then of course he stuck around for all five of the following series. A little bit of hindsight corner there. A little bit earlier he also got root out with an absolute peach that hit the stumps again. Wasn't quite as good as the famous one to Alastair Cook 6 months later, but it was right up there. And he also got Cook and Trott out as well.
Not a bad bunch of players to get out.
Yeah, and I do like, because of his efforts, England were all out for 330, which meant Australia needed one run less than 300 to win, which I think gave them the psychological advantage.
I'll tell you what that's down to. That's down to Tony Hill's jacket.
It is indeed, yes. Yes. And the final thing I want to mention, just as part of this nomination, is that Australia only had two wicket takers in this innings. Ryan Harris with his 7 for 117 and Nathan Lyon with 3 for 55. Neither had been selected for the first test of the series. So I'm not sure what that says.
Yeah, I remember at the time feeling a bit like there was a race for England to win the series before Australia worked out who they should be picking, because they'd started off so mental. Felt like we can quickly just rush to a 3-0 lead before they work out who they should be picking. We'll be good. My next nomination is a bit of a niche one, when I was watching it, this appealed to me so much, I thought I've got to make this my actual nomination. It's probably, maybe there's things that other people would appreciate more. We've got to true to yourself, haven't you? And this was a thing that just really, really fascinated me. And it's England's ball-flinging wicket celebrations on the final day. And one in particular, one more than the other. There's two. It was the first and last wickets of Australia's innings. And the first one is when Jonathan Trott caught Chris Rogers' lip. Now, there are certain conventions in wicket celebrations. Like, you generally run towards your teammates. Jonathan Trott took this catch low and dead centre. It was one of those where, as a slip fielder, you barely have to move. You know, your hands in the right position. Anyway, just dead central. He then instantly turned 90 degrees to his right and started running like there was somewhere he absolutely had to immediately be. And that place was leg slip. So everyone's swarming towards the bowler and Trott's off sideways. What did he do when he got to leg slip? Well, another wicket celebration is that you throw the ball upwards, don't you?
Yes.
That's the normal thing to do. Launch it skywards. When he arrived at leg slip, Trott instead tried to launch the ball over the square leg boundary. Like when you're returning the ball from the outfield, like a huge, powerful, flat throw. But the thing that really makes it for me, what I most love about this, is how he just instantly embarks on these actions. There's no, facial change. He takes the catch and he just, heads off to the right as if it was a job he already had in mind and he really needed to urgently get on with. It's my absolute favourite part of that. It's the thing only Jonathan Trott could really pull off, I reckon.
Yeah.
And then the second wicket, sort of bookending it, was Jimmy Anderson's celebration after taking the final catch. Jimmy at least acknowledged that the ball's supposed to go up, but instead of underarm it, like is the absolute logical way to do it, he sort of tilted backwards and launched a full-blooded sidearm throw, but dead vertically. As you see him sort of about to throw, you can't work out how he manages, but he just sort of hinges backwards like you've got sort of a Lego man legs on backwards or something.
Yeah, it's the kind of thing that you wouldn't want him doing today at his current age, right? You'd throw your back out if you tried that.
No, I think he must do plenty of like yoga, Pilates,
you would hope so,
stuff. Yeah. I don't know, but it looked like a spinal risk. And it's a powerful throw. Yeah. Like, I honestly would not be at all surprised to learn that the ball left the Earth's atmosphere. He properly slatted.
Well, there was lots of talk at the time about England's like one percenters, how they were just working on all these things to just give themselves marginal edges. And I like to think even their celebrations were somehow being optimised in ways I can't begin to fathom.
Yeah, maybe they were roughing up the ball a bit with Jonathan Trott's square leg throw.
Who knows?
I can get this in the... While everyone's watching the celebrations, I will land this in the stands and scuff it up a bit more. Yep.
And you'd be practised it so it always landed on the correct side for the scuffing.
Yeah, and that's why he looks so determined about it. He basically, like, the camera of, like, trying to... The cameraman is trying to capture all the celebrations. Jonathan Trott's just having none of it, because where everything's happening,
he's not.
Just running in the opposite direction.
Yeah.
I remember a friend telling me once, it's a little bit like, he said that he was standing outside, he was at university, and there was fire drill in the library, and everyone was just like, he said, there were just tons of people in there just warming out or out of lecture halls, I don't know what it was. And he said he could see one guy in headphones just walking in, completely oblivion. It was kind of like that.
Excellent. All right, my final nomination is Australia's Crazy Hour. So this is Australia, as we mentioned, we're chasing 300 for victory, or 299 to be precise. And they start off really well, a century opening partnership between Warner and Rogers. And then they pretty much got almost halfway there, just one wicket down. They were 147 for one. And Swan got Khawaja LBW, but they were still pretty much cruising. And then Warner was out at 5:44 p.m. on the fourth day. And Australia at that point were 168 for three. And less than an hour later, so at 6:38 p.m, they were 181 for seven. And Haddam was out. They'd lost 5 for 13. Broad had destroyed them. And that was pretty much it. England mopped up the tail to win the test on the fourth evening. I do remember that I went to bed as Australia were kind of going. I thought, oh, well, maybe I'll wake up tomorrow and this could be poised really interestingly at the beginning of the fifth day. Nah, not at all. All done.
So there's a slight tangent here, but just talking about like them being 181 for seven at 6:38 p.m. I was going to put this in the unnominated moments in a minute, but the play went on way past 7 o'clock in this. I think it had done at the end of the previous test as well. And I remember at the time that what this meant was that they were still playing live when they were broadcasting the highlights. And all I could ever think about if I was watching the highlights, you know, if I'd recorded watching them later on or something, or maybe, I don't know, maybe I was watching the highlights live, if you see what I mean. But in any case, when I was watching them, all I could think was the poor editor and like the job that they had to do editing something which hadn't even finished. And then the closer you got to the close, like presumably the match, like that almost coincided.
Yes.
Oh, terrifying.
But yeah, I mean, presumably by the end, they just edited, you know, 10 minutes short and just said, all right, you can watch the last 10 minutes of the test now.
Yeah, basically. But then there's always the risk that they'll just go off and then you've got 10 minutes to fill.
Yes, that's true. Yeah. So anyway, in that crazy hour or whatever it was, 54 minutes, this is what happened. Warner was caught behind off Brezhnev. This one kind of jumped off a length. That started the clock. Then Broad got Clark to an absolute beautiful delivery.
Yeah, that was nice.
Smith managed to hook the ball onto his own stumps somehow. So that was a neat trick from Steve Smith. Watson came out. You want to guess how he was out?
I'll take a punt. Was he clean bowled?
He was out LBW.
Oh, no, are you kidding? Did you review it?
He did review it, and it was going on to hit the stumps. Haddon did, in Watto's defence, Haddon did tell him to review it. They had a few reviews up their sleeve because Watson opening. So there were reviews left for the number six batter. And there was also a review left for Brad Haddon, who also reviewed an LBW. And again, it was umpire's call, but it was still out, and the review was therefore lost. So they were the wickets that fell in that crazy period. And that was pretty much the end of the test for Australia. Or the end of any chance of winning it, let's say.
Yeah, I mean, it's a Wasim and Wakarian all-ball scorecard. Yes. We used to have this quite a lot. There's one particular series where the Pakistan were over, where England were just sort of routinely getting like 100 or even 200 for like none. Something absolutely insane, and then they were all out for like 203.
All right, so do we have any unnominated moments?
Well, I got at least one. I used the 7 p.m. one already. The other one was not really related to this match, but Monty Panesar was left out of the squad for this test. And it was around this time that he was fined by the ECB after being ejected from a Brighton nightclub called Shush for bothering women before urinating off a balcony over the bouncer who chucked him out. It's quite a famous story about Monty Panesar.
Poor Monty. See, I just assumed that Monty's urination was just, you know, overflow, excuse the phrase, from the England players' celebrations after winning the Ashes in the previous test. Because I think we forgot to mention this. After the England won the Ashes, the England players kind of infamously urinated on the pitch to celebrate after the third test.
Yeah, the way it was reported was that players urinated on the pitch while their teammates cheered them on, which I don't know. It feels like that's a sort of...
embellishment?
Yeah. And maybe there was some cheering or a deliberate misreading of the situation, I suspect. Like maybe they was like singing the team song and one guy was off, had wandered off to take a slash. I don't know.
Anyway, you can see how that behaviour would impact an easily influenced young man like Monty.
Yeah. He spoke about the incident a few years later. It was reported in a Daily Mail article that was headlined, "The Worst Idea I've Ever Had."
I've seen him on Mastermind. That's not the worst idea.
Yeah, there's a few worse ideas in that round, the general knowledge round. He said his Sussex teammates defended him when the bouncer caught him. It was the ultimate team building exercise, he said, or at least it would have been if the club hadn't been about to sack me.
Oh, Monty. Fantastic stuff.
Oh, Monty. I mean, it was actually, you're not really laughing, man. It was quite dark times.
Yes, it is.
Set aside one man's existential crisis.
All right. I also have an unnominated nomination kind of related to squads being picked. So Mitchell Starc was left out of this test and Jackson Bird came in to replace him. And I was a bit of a Bird fan before this test and I became a little bit less so after it. He didn't bowl particularly well. But I have always like the fact that Bird is a generic brand version of Glenn Pigeon McGrath. So I really enjoy that. And perhaps the highlight of Bird's play in this test was that he did get Alastair Cook out in the first innings, which I mostly just like because there was a graphic that read Bird to Cook, which I assume is like a frozen chicken or something.
Exactly how much of your Jackson Bird fandom was down to the potential for wordplay?
At least 99 to 102%.
Well, I haven't got any others. That's me done.
Let's see who won this ridiculous Ashes test then.
Well, the first thing I'm going to say, and the first thing, you might not like this, but Australia's crazy hour. I want to diminish Australia's crazy hour because there is a large Stuart Broad element aspect to that, which I think surely tempers it as an Australian nomination. And I appreciate they lost all those wickets in 1 hour, but, you know, if Stuart Broad's involved, and he was involved.
It is always hard to know with a collapse that... you know, who to give the credit to, but if it's broad,
then I'm more inclined to take some sort of English influence over that. If it had been Brezhnev,
yes,
you could have had that, definitely. That would have been Harry Kirry on Australia's part. But, you know, if Broad's there, he's got to be having an influence.
Yeah, I guess that's fair. I guess I could flip that around a little bit and say that, you know, England's T20 dot ballathon was something to do with Australia's tight bowling. One of whom was Shane Watson, yet another legendary ridiculous cricketer. So I think we kind of even one another out there.
Well, we've knackered those two up. We're going to have to try and find at least three things. Is there any others that we've got issues with?
To be honest, I'm not overly keen on Ryan Harris bowling people. I'm not quite sure how ridiculous that is.
Oh, you're going to argue against yourself? Sorry, I should have predicted that. I thought we were loggerheads trying to take control of the voting there. But I didn't move into this phase where we start arguing against ourselves.
Yeah. I mean, Ryan Harris did bowl a lot of people in his career, so I'm not sure exactly.
He did bowl a lot in that match as well.
Yes. So I think that undercuts that one a little bit. And kind of, so I think the Watson-Rogers opening partnership is definitely my strongest nomination.
I would say Ian Bell. This match is a perfect example of what the Summer of Bell was all about. And the Summer of Bell is such a perfect example of what Ian Bell was all about, in the sense of how it affected how people perceived him and the fact that he could just never really win.
Yeah.
So I think Ian Bell is my strongest.
I would agree with that. I think the Summer of Bell, I mean, even as an Australian, it's just like, what? Who? Ian Bell? What's going on here?
And then 6 months later, not really. Yeah. Just like, it was like some vivid dream. So do we think that could be a three-pointer here?
I think so. I think it's. I think the only one that I could fight with it is the Watson-Rogers partnership, which does, you know, have a little bit of DRS nonsense thrown into the mix. So
yeah.
It's got a lot of good little elements, but I'm not sure it can match the Summer of Bell, particularly taken as a whole.
Okay. Well, let's go with that for three then. Yep. So two and one to be decided. My remaining nomination, but the other one we've not mentioned is England's ball-flinging wicket celebrations. And I struggled to sort of be impartial on this one, because I just have this image of Jonathan Trott doing his right-hand turn and just heading off, and he's doing his own thing, as he so often did. And it just makes me smile, but I appreciate that it might be quite a personal one.
It is silly. I'm not sure it's extraordinarily ridiculous. There are a lot of celebrations in cricket. You know, you don't have to be too far along. Well, I was going to say the bell curve, but yeah.
I think it's the fact that it's a Jonathan Trott one, and I've always found Jonathan Trott a funny cricketer, so I think it's maybe quite a personal one for me.
Well, I'm going to propose, I'll just put out a suggestion here, and you let me know what you think. I'm going to say Bell 3, Watson Rogers 2, and then the Crazy Hour 1, because that Crazy Hour, that was very crazy.
Yeah.
Despite Broad's involvement, or because of Broad's involvement, but I'm still claiming it for Australia. Steve Smith hooked a ball into his own stumps. Come on.
That is true. He did. Well, I'm persuaded. I mean, what was my other one? The T20. I mean, we've diminished both of those, but how much have we diminished them? Is the T20 not on a par, you don't think, with Crazy Hour?
Wickets are always more entertaining than dot balls.
Yeah, and I suppose the match kind of stagnated there, which is pretty ridiculous. But the ridiculous thing about Australia is they were halfway
to victory.
Towards victory. And then within an hour were significantly greater distance towards defeat.
Yes.
Okay, I'll buy that.
Yeah, and within an hour where just about everybody in Australia was asleep. So we all woke up and went, oh, for fuck's sake.
Oh, well, I can certainly sympathise with that. Okay, then, let's go with that then. So Ian Bell has effectively salvaged a draw for England with his heroics, his series-long heroics, with 2 points and 1 points for Australia. So 3 points each.
Yeah, which means we're one all going into the fifth and final test.
Got a live test again.
All right. Well, I think that wraps us up. So thank you for listening. You can check out Alex's website. He's over at kingcricket.co.uk. You can check out mine. That's at leibcricket.com. You can follow us on Twitter, either combined, at Ridiculous Ashes, or at the King's Tweets, or at Leib Cricket for Alex and myself, respectively. And if you enjoyed this episode and want to give us money for some reason, Alex is at patreon.com/kingcricket, and I'm at patreon.com/leibcricket. And we will be back in a week with our coverage of the fifth, final, and deciding test of the 2013 Ridiculous Ashes. See you then.
Thanks.
Podcast Network.